Hello, everybody, and I have to. I know it's all this formal stuff, but I really do have to take the opportunity to thank those two Haridans out there who are not listening for creating this excellent workshop. And it's a great pleasure to be here. I have to say that this is not the title I thought of. They gave it to me, so I've tried to be very obedient and do something around it. Okay. I know that you're all really tired and exhausted and etc. So I'll try not to make it too horrible. But anyway, what I begin with is just to sort of point out that this particular recent crisis is unusual, actually, in terms of the synchronicity. If you look at the way growth rates have changed in the last 5 years in particular, what you'll find is that every single region of the world economy has experienced this decline. And this is the very first time it's happened in a very, very long time. In other words, we haven't had the simultaneous collapse of all the major regions of the world economy in quite the same way, which tells us that globalization managed to do some of what it had set out to do, which is to really integrate the really integrate the economies of the world. In particular, there was this whole argument that, you know, China and India are decoupled, they don't have to have the same kind of problems. But if you look at it, it's true that it's still positive, but very sharp declines in rates of growth of China and India as well. And of course, if you look at it in terms of the sheer number of countries that have been affected, very large number of countries with declining per capita incomes. 2010 is a projection of the UN, so we don't know what's going to happen. But certainly, already in 2009, it's very clear that you have a very large number of countries with declining GDP. But, and here is the killer, this crisis starts in the developed world. It's clearly the result of the whole, you know, boom and bust thing in the US. We all know about the nature of the financial deregulation and the imbalances that created this particular collapse in the US. But who's the hardest hit? The developing countries. If you're looking at sheer declines in per capita income, increases in poverty, changes in employment, massive increases in unemployment and so on, it is developing countries which are the hardest hit. And it's also, yet more truth that, you know, there is no justice in this world, because many of the countries and sections of the population that are the worst hit are the ones that didn't benefit from the previous boom. Okay, they are really the ones who didn't, many of the booming countries, for example, did not experience rising real wages, even during the period of the economic expansion, but now they're getting falling real wages and falling employment and so on. So it's particularly interesting that this is a global collapse in which the developing countries that did not cause the problem, many of whom had so-called very strong fundamentals and so on, have all been very adversely affected, and sections of the population that didn't benefit from the boom have been particularly hard hit. What's also worth noting is that the response to the crisis has been very, very asymmetrical throughout the world. We have actually a situation where in some of the worst affected countries, which again, as I said, are badly affected not for faults of their own, but in some of these worst affected countries, you can't get the same kind of fiscal responses because they have, unfortunately, constraints in terms of fiscal expansion for all the reasons we were talking about when we were discussing Randi's paper. They have external constraints and fiscal constraints that do not allow them to do counter-cyclical policies, okay? So that they are really particularly badly hit. What are the main mechanisms? I thought I had a chart here. Oh, I've lost a whole slide. Okay, there are a number of mechanisms, okay, for this to happen. And the most important mechanism is obviously exports, or one of the most important mechanisms is exports. And as you can see, 12% decline this year, says the IMF. The World Trade Organization says 15% decline. Anyway, it's going to decline, okay, quite sharply, world trade this year, and probably also next year. But, and here is what I'd like you to note, it's not just that the world trade values are declining, this 12%. What is really interesting here is that both the trade value and the trade volume index are declining. Okay, unit values are falling very sharply. Unit values of trade are falling very, very sharply. Okay, so prices are coming down, volumes are coming down as well. What does it mean? It means that developing countries, in this desperate competitive urge, well, developing in all countries, to be fair, in this urge to push out more exports in this very increasingly difficult global market, are reducing unit values of exports, but it's not helping. Okay, because the recession is so sharp that the volumes also are falling. In other words, especially the large exporting developing countries are hit by a double whammy. Okay, they are losing in terms of the volume of exports, which means they're losing domestic employment and output and so on. They're losing in terms of the unit value of exports. Okay, so they're getting less for what they're exporting as well. And one important mechanism for this to happen is exchange rate devaluation. When we're looking at a whole range of developing countries, and keep China out of it for now, okay, because it's a whole different thing in China. you know the feeling, right? But everywhere else, many, many countries, you have fairly significant exchange rate devaluation. I think I have a slide later on which will show you. And why are we having this very significant exchange rate devaluation? Because of capital flows. So when I said exports is a major mechanism, another faster mechanism this time around has been capital flows. The reversal of capital flows, of gross private capital flows, the reversal of those flows has been one big story of the current crisis. It's a very rapid one. It starts from about March, April 2008. And rapidly gains pace. By about October, it's a flood. Okay, the capital running back to the U.S. You can really see the impact of it from June onwards in for most developing economies, and it's coming back. Why? It's coming back not because suddenly developing countries have become unsafe and bad, and their fundamentals are bad and so on. Quite the opposite. Most of these countries, the fundamentals are much better than the country they're flying back to, which is the U.S. Okay. What's happening is that essentially finance has got to cover its losses in the subprime and other markets here, and they have to come back and ensure liquidity for transactions. So as the losses in the U.S. housing market and other financial markets in other financial institutions in the U.S. mounts, finance basically comes back to the U.S. and to Europe, to Western Europe, I should say. Okay? That's the story until about October, November. And from then, as you have this wave of what is de facto nationalization of many of these financial institutions, there is also what has been called financial protectionism, which is that the banks in the developed world are more or less told, well, listen, you first lend here. Don't go out and lend to a whole lot of other countries. Your job is to first ease the domestic credit crunch, make sure you're lending in these countries, okay, so that you actually have a significant reduction in external commercial borrowing. Portfolio flows have rushed back, okay. FDI has started feeling insecure, so it's not going very much. Borrowing turns negative from October onwards, or rather, lending turns negative from October onwards, so you have all these major forms of capital coming back. And of course, ODA, which turns out to be heavily, heavily pro-cyclical. Okay, aid was never, we didn't think it was pro-cyclical because it was so small anyway, right, during the boom. So we thought that, you know, this is something which is just already at the minimum. Well, we were wrong. It wasn't at the minimum. It was actually capable of reducing very, very rapidly. And as in particular countries, the least developed countries have found, there's been a very dramatic reduction in ODA in just the period, again, from about September onwards. So that's all of this has added to the, by the way, a factoid of some interest is that the total amount of ODA in the last 40 years from the north to the south, total north to total south, is less than the bailout of AIG. Okay. So it just gives you some idea of the numbers involved. But of course, this nevertheless had significant impact for small developing countries who no longer access it. okay, remittance incomes too would be badly affected. Everybody expected them to be very badly affected. But this is a little bit more complex. They turn out to be less badly affected than people thought they would be. Okay, around the middle of 2008, you will find the World Bank and various other organizations all saying, oh my God, remittances is the next big disaster, and all these countries, all these migrants are going to come back. And remittances, as you know, played a huge part in shoring up the balance of payments in many developing countries over the last 10 years in particular. All of Central America, Mexico and Central America, large parts of Asia, Philippines, Sri Lanka, you know, large parts of Africa. It was the single most important source of foreign exchange. It was the largest single export of labor. And really, that shored up the balance of payments. For most countries, it was more than, it was the single largest export, but it was more than all forms of capital inflow put together. So it played a huge role, okay? And the expectation was that this is going to really decline massively. It hasn't happened so far to the same extent, okay? And there are a couple of reasons for this. There was an expectation that, you know, this collapse in the destination countries is going to cause a lot of migrants to go home. But migrants don't want to go home when the conditions in the home market are even worse, okay? And of course, the more undocumented they are, the less incentive they have to go back, because anyway, they're illegal and undocumented. And so there's no point really in going back to even worse conditions back home. But another single particular aspect which is often not noted is the gender dimension. Because as you know, this is a phase when women were moving much more than ever before. And in many countries, much more than men. In the Philippines, women migrant workers outnumber men 12 to 1. In Sri Lanka, it's 8 to 1. Okay? Now, female migrant workers are actually employed in dominantly the care and entertainment sectors. Okay? Male migrants are in industry, construction. So the male migrant workers are very, very sensitive to the business cycle. They lose jobs immediately when the, you know, when the downswing comes, because construction, manufacturing, these are the first to be hit. But women migrants, in the care economy, it takes much longer. And of course, the care economy is affected by all kinds of things. It's affected by the demographic tendencies. It's affected by the social changes that have occurred. You know, the ability of women to pass on a lot of their own unpaid labor. And so all of these things. So we find that in general, countries that have more women migrants show much greater resilience over the cycle. Okay, and remittances do not respond exactly in the same way. That's why, for example, in Sri Lanka and Philippines, there hasn't been a decline in remittances yet. In the Philippines, the latest data saying it's still going up, much less. It's going up by only 2%, but it's still increasing rather than falling. Okay, even in India, it has not yet fallen. We have some female migrants, but we have also a lot of these IT workers who are supposed to be very badly hit. But there's another impact, which is that when workers do come home, if they are, you know, regular migrants and so on, when they come home, they tend to bring their accumulated savings with them. So in the first instance, you'll get a bunching of remittances. They will come home with more, so you'll actually have an increase, a spike, which will then deteriorate. So anyway, so far, we haven't seen the same decline in remittances. But otherwise, exports and capital flows significantly down. And that, of course, has given you the exchange rate devaluations, which have all these other effects. Okay, so if that's the case, how does the impact of the crisis work out? Well, one of the first things that is evident, of course, is a retrogression in the production systems. That is, many of the exports of these developing countries were, in fact, not just the typical standard labor-intensive things, but industries subject to economies of scale. So you actually have a peculiar situation where you're running down your scale of operations, so your per unit cost should be rising, but you're unable to actually increase the price of your exports because you have this terrible competitive market where you can't actually compete without lowering your unit values. So you have no choice but to cut down on wages, profit margins also, but basically you really have to cut down your costs as far as possible. And associated with that, there's already evidence of occasionally, not universally, but you get examples of a retrogression of production systems, of shifts of technology back to earlier forms, okay, less quote-unquote modern kinds of technology in a whole range of activities, fishing, for example. And of course, big impact on employment, it's kind of obvious. It's not just that there are the newly unemployed, those who lose their jobs. It is that the informal sector actually finds that there are much reduced work prospects. Now remember, informal sector in most of our countries is characterized by a high degree of underemployment. Okay, quite a lot of disguised unemployment and low wages for that reason, low remuneration. And this tends to increase. So what we find is not so much that these are jobless workers, but that their jobs bring them less income because they're able to do or find less productive work over the month or the year. Okay, so you have that particular impact. A big impact is on the youth entering the labor force who basically don't get jobs. Okay, and that's significant because at least South Asia, West Asia, and some parts of sub-Saharan Africa are dominantly young populations. We already, West Asia already has, I'm sure Niloufar knows more than me, I think the unemployment rate among youth is 28%. Was 28% last year. I don't know what it is now, okay? So we are talking about a very, very sharp increase in unemployment among youth, which of course has different social, political consequences from just overall unemployment, I think. And of course, more than the external migrants, I've just told you the external thing is not as bad as many had anticipated so far. Internal migrants, you know, the previous boom was characterized by fairly large shifts of workers from rural to urban areas or semi-urban areas to different kinds of employment. Very large shifts in terms of returning migrants internally. In China, it's estimated that at least 45 million workers have gone home. In India, nobody knows. We don't have any sense of the numbers, but informal estimates suggest about 15 to 20 million at the moment. And the Ministry of Labor also thinks it's about 20 million. Wage rates, this is the other aspect. I don't remember any other crisis where there has been such a sharp decline in nominal wage rates. Okay, this whole wage stickiness thing doesn't seem to exist anymore. And it seems to be widespread. It's true apparently also in the US, but it is very, very marked in most of the developing world that nominal wage rates are declining for a large number of occupations. And in piece rate work done by women, the nominal rates for piece rate work have also been falling quite sharply. One aspect, again, that doesn't get talked about much is the agrarian crisis. We used to talk about it. There was this whole thing about how there was a crisis of farming related to WTO, related to the decline in subsidies, related to the absence of public protection for farmers, related to the decline in research and extension work of in agriculture and so on. There has been an agrarian crisis in large parts of the developing world where basically cultivation isn't viable. It's not financially viable. The costs are more than the price of the output, okay? And farmers have been dealing with this by borrowing to somehow tide over for the next year and then finding in the following year also that they're unable to repay and have to take on more debt. In India, of course, some of you may have heard it got expressed in a very sharp increase in farmer suicides. We've had 200,000 farmer suicides in the decade up to 2007, which is a pretty large number. And in other countries, it's been expressed one of the reasons for the whole migration that created the remittance thing is the decline in viability of peasant cultivation. So that, for example, you know, Mexican peasants cultivating corn, okay, it was no longer viable unless you had at least one migrant Mexican worker working in a U.S. farm, okay, who was sending the remittances back and so on. So you have this impact of the agrarian crisis. Now, what is interesting about the agrarian crisis? We knew why it would have happened between 96 and 2002, okay? Because world prices were falling, input prices in developing countries were rising, so it's kind of obvious, okay? There's a scissors impact. But after 2002, world prices went up. So why should there still be an agrarian crisis? Well, it turns out that prices received by farmers in most developing countries did not go up the same way world prices went up. And of course, between 2007 and 2008, when world prices zoomed, went through the roof, most farmers in developing countries did not benefit at all. They really did not get any of those gains. I'll talk about that in the conference, so I'm not going to go on about it here. But essentially what happens is that the basic financial viability problem, the problem of input costs rising faster than output prices, that hasn't gone away even during the period of rising output crop prices. And therefore, the agrarian crisis remains a huge issue. Lots of other features of that, declining public investment, all of that. But let's note that this is also a big feature. It also means that agriculture can't be your refuge sector. Okay, they're also in bad shape. So the migrant workers who are rushing back are not going to find safe and secure livelihood on the farms. Obviously, all this will affect food security. But here is another aspect, which is that global food prices zoomed up, as you all know. They went up more than 3-4 times in the space of just 14 months. Wheat, rice, important corn, etc. Okay. They came down again then. They came down to almost where they were at the beginning of that last spike. But they didn't come down in developing countries. So in most developing countries, food prices have continued to rise, even though nominal incomes are falling. Okay? So obviously you're going to get a food security problem. Doesn't take much to look at that. Health, again, what is the health impact? Well, in many developing countries, I won't say most, but in many developing countries, a significant part of the health expenditure is out-of-pocket expenditure. It's done by private households because the public health systems have been run down, are inadequate, are close to collapse. Okay? And the health expenditure, well, in India, for example, as much as 94% of total health expenditure is household out-of-pocket expenditure. Now, when you're in a situation of nominal wage declines, nominal income declines of farmers, and increasing food costs, obviously you cut down on other expenditures. And one, the quick surveys, I'm sure Indira will be able to tell us more, but one of the findings certainly in India, also in the Philippines, also in Indonesia, is that health expenditures have been cut, and they have been cut, first of all, on guess who, women and girls. Okay, so that there is this direct impact in terms of the health. And again, education of children, especially where the schools are not free or where there are additional costs like textbooks, uniforms, and so on, especially girls and after the primary stage have been withdrawn from school. Okay, now this is all the bad news, yeah? But there's more bad news, I'm sorry. to get through before we get to any possibility of blessings in disguise, which is that it's not just that it has these direct effects. Crises do more than just give you a bad time when they happen, okay? They also can change growth trajectories. And that is what is very important to learn from previous crises. And the crisis that I would like to look at specifically are the East Asian crisis of 97, 10 years ago. We saw it happen and we know what impact it can have now on developing countries. What really had the basic change in the growth trajectory in East Asia, if you remember, the East Asian boom was one of those export-led booms based on very high investment rates, okay, very high savings rates, but even higher investment rates, which therefore meant the inflow of foreign capital, which fueled export production, which they sent out to the US and Europe and so on, okay? Many factors leading up to that particular crisis, beginning with the Chinese devaluation in 94, the slowdown of the export markets. In 96, export markets are stagnant. That changes expectations. Capital flies out. George Soros comes in as the agent of change, shall we say, and you have currency crises across the region. Okay? What happens after the crisis? That's what is useful for us to look at. There was a significant change in the pattern of investment and savings, okay? And this was related, first of all, to income distribution, okay? But secondly, also to the fiscal stance of the governments. And what this does is that it actually makes these primary effects of the crisis that I've talked about, it magnifies them into these indirect secondary effects because of the impact on the savings and investment rates. Here are some examples. Let's look at, okay, this is South Korea, okay? The red line is GDP growth. You can see how it plops, but then it goes up again. So everybody will say, oh, South Korea's had this wonderful recovery. The Economist put it on the front cover, I remember, in 2000 or something. Here's this wonderful economy that has shown how quickly you can recover and so on, okay? The green line is the savings rate, which was already pretty high, huh? About 35%. It goes up to nearly 50%, and it stays at that level after the crisis. We are talking about an economy in crisis, and you have a savings rate of 45 to 50% of GDP. It goes up and stays up, okay? What happens to investment rates, though? The blue line, also very high, it was more or less the same, and then it just plummets. It halves, okay? So investment collapses in South Korea. What happens to Malaysia? Same thing exactly. Here's the red line with the growth. There's your green line with the savings rate. Similar kind of, you know, 45 to 50%. Where's the investment rate? It does less than half, okay? Really huge collapse in the investment rate in Malaysia. What happens to the Philippines? Now, Philippines didn't really get much of a boom, okay? But you got the crash, okay? So here's the red line, very volatile growth, okay? Very, very volatile. But look at the green line of the savings rate. From a real laggard savings rate of 20%, it goes up to 35% on average, okay? What happens to investment? Slow and continuous decline. Indonesia, I'm sorry to bore you with this, but there are only five major crisis economies. Look at Indonesia, same thing. To a slightly lesser extent, but the pattern is very marked. Pre-crisis, investment more than savings, both high. Post-crisis, savings more than investment, and the gap is very large. Okay? The only exception is Thailand, where it happens for a while, but then the investment rate recovers. Okay? And it recovers essentially because, which is why we realize that Thaksin Shinawatra is still so popular. Because the economic policies of Thaksin emphasize public investment and inclusive banking. Okay? Which is why he still gets all those votes. He may be, you know, a terrible guy in every other respect and Thailand's Berlusconi and everything, but he manages to generate this rise in the investment rate. Okay? Through, and that's the only one that survives this particular tendency. One of the reasons this is happening is not just because of tight money policies. Tight money policies were a very important reason, okay? IMF came in, even when IMF wasn't there, in the Malaysian case, everybody buys the whole neoliberal line that you have to, you know, have this very tight control over monetary policy, and they make life very difficult for those who want to access money for investment, okay? So that's one, clearly one reason, and of course, all questions of inclusive monetary policy disappear, except in the Thai case, as I mentioned. But another very important reason this happens is because the governments get obsessive about controlling the fiscal deficit. Now, remember, they were not bad performers. It's true, Indonesia had a fiscal deficit of 8% of GDP, okay? But everybody else, I mean, Thailand and South Korea had fiscal surplus, 3% of GDP before the crisis. But they were very good boys. They listened to this thing that fiscal deficit is bad, okay? So they all really cut down on public spending and try to avoid deficits as much as possible. Here is, okay, unlike these other guys, the United States, which is, oh my goodness, sorry. The United States is the dark blue line over here, where the fiscal deficit, it's in surplus towards the end of the Clinton thing and then zooms up, okay? The euro area, deficits of, well, this is a pretend deficit. We all know that they fudged the accounts in Europe because of their stupid fiscal the growth and stability pact, okay, the 3% thing. But nonetheless, it is in that range of 3%, okay? Developing countries as a group, pretty low fiscal deficits, 3% coming down to 1%. But look at the Asian NICs, the crisis countries. That's this blue line here. It's a fiscal surplus, very small deficit of 1%, and then down to surpluses all the way. Okay? So they are really constraining themselves, which means what? That they're not spending on the basic things that you have to be spending on. I mean, not just, you know, health, education, and all that, but just roads, infrastructure, all of those kinds of things which also add to growth. Okay, if it's all this bad news, then what am I saying, you know, blessing in disguise business? You know, how can it be a blessing in disguise? What's so good about all this? It's good because, you see, this previous boom that we had globally, it's not just that it was unsustainable internally and that was based on this, you know, Minsky bubble and all that kind of thing. It's also that it was very fundamentally unequal. It was based on inequality. It was based on inequality within countries, including, you know, across classes, regions, and gender. But it was also based on inequality between countries. It is internationally that this is a period when the South was subsidizing the North. The South paid for this global boom, and in particular for the boom in the US. How did it pay for it? Through very cheap exports, through this whole export obsession that caused all of us to compete with each other and underprice our exports like anything. Through capital flows, we were exporting capital to the US, either directly and through private guys or indirectly through our reserves, which we then parked with US Treasury bills and in safe US securities. Cheap labor, because our agrarian crisis, our lack of employment opportunities at home, drove labor into the US to provide for the cheap migrants that kept labor costs down in the US and costs down in the US as well. So we were subsidizing this boom, okay? And it was appalling that we were subsidizing this boom because we were using resources that we should have been using for our own development project. These are countries that have not fulfilled the development project yet, okay? Within our economies, it's not just this inequality was international. Within our economies, we had deep inequality and growing inequality so that all our booms were based on inequality, including India and China, okay? Workers therefore subsidized capital in a variety of ways. In the northern economies, it's this extraordinary situation where basically debt is replacing wages as capitalist payment. Okay, they keep wages low and then they offer you consumer credit, which you then, you know, spend and then eventually come to a crash. In developing countries, not wages stagnated. It's most extraordinary that in India, during the period when we had 8 to 10% real GDP growth, real wages fell, according to our official data. In China, real wages increased in manufacturing, but if you look at the wages of migrant workers and service sector workers in the informal sector, they did not increase. They actually were stagnant. Okay? And in many other countries, basically, huge decline in wage shares, huge increase in profit shares of GDP, and therefore, you know, a very, very marked income distributional shift, which was workers subsidizing capital for this particular boom. And of course, a major part of this, I mean, Stephanie has written about this vastly, I'm sure all of you know this very well by now, the exploitation of female labor, both paid and unpaid, was a critical element of this, okay? Paid because of the fact that in the exporting and other sectors, you could use much cheaper female labor. Unpaid because a huge range of public services were being progressively cut down and being handed over to household unpaid labor, dominantly female, not only female. Of course, there's another bad thing about this boom, which is that it wasn't just workers we were exploiting. We were exploiting nature in this completely unsustainable way. And so, in a sense, the boom was also associated with very rapacious and completely unsustainable patterns of production and consumption. It's not just in the US where you apparently replace sofa sets every year because otherwise the Chinese can't export them. But in developing countries too, where we have, the elite has developed that particular US style of production, sorry, US style of consumption, which demands a certain style of production. You know, the same residential patterns of, you know, moving to suburbs and therefore requiring individual motor cars, the same elite patterns of consumption, which are unsustainable and which therefore sooner or later would have to be coming to an end. So in a sense, that boom was not okay. It's just as well that boom has ended. But it's unfortunate it has ended in this crash. Is this still a blessing? Yes. Why is it still a blessing? Because it gives us an opportunity for changed strategies. I think unlike the previous booms, when every time that whole thing came to this crashing end, this is a case where you cannot blame mismanagement, crony capitalism, you know, the fact that all these developing country people just don't know how to manage their economies, the IMF didn't get there in time, whatever. Okay, you can't blame all of that. This is clearly a crisis of neoliberalism. It's clearly the collapse of the efficient markets hypothesis. You can't actually explain this one away, okay? So there is, except in India, I regret to say, but other than that, our policymakers are, I think we're the last, you know, we have the last Mohicans in terms of the neoliberals. In general, I think this is a model that has received a severe battering among both governments and people in general. Keynesian fiscal stimuli are no longer seen as impossible and improbable and so on and so forth. There is now an opportunity for changed patterns of international trade and capital flows. We don't need to only export to the US and give them more sofa sets. We don't need to send our capital to the US. We can actually think of development of our own economies through different patterns of trade, through the home market, through et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so there is an opportunity for newer patterns of trade and capital flows. There's an opportunity in all of our countries to move to wage-led growth rather than profit-led growth. This whole thing was based on profit-led accumulation strategies. We can actually move away from that. And that, of course, means you have to bring back emphasis not just on public spending, but certain kinds of public spending, on food distribution, on health, on education. However, there's a problem, which is that what we've seen already in the fiscal and other responses to the crisis that have occurred already, that there's already a male breadwinner bias in many of the responses, okay? Already we've seen that, you know, you allow male heads of household to determine the nature and content of the assistance received, that when you have employment schemes that are dominantly oriented to male employment, they're based on heavy earthwork or, you know, different kinds of things. The role of women as productive agents, not just in household work, but as economically productive agents outside housework is not recognized. When you do expand the public services, there is a tendency to use massively underpaid women. For example, the Indian health program, now we have a National Rural Health Mission, which is run by women who in the first 2 years of the program were completely unpaid. They only got training. And now, because there's been an outcry, they are being paid $10 a month, okay? Which even in India is well below the minimum wage, okay? And so on and so forth. And of course, not recognizing the fact that a crisis generates much more unpaid work. None of these has been recognized. Oh, final slide. Okay, great. So I think that's it for this thing. Thanks.
I'm just wondering if you can speak a bit more about how you see it is a blessing in disguise to question neoliberal policies, because what I see is the exact opposite, actually. We're asking for a larger IMF. We're renewing the mandates of the IMF, asking for an increased scope. And at the basis of that request, there's no true questioning of the neoliberal policies.
And I have a question about if you could elaborate a bit, like, through which mechanisms the falling food prices were not reflected in the developing world.
Yeah, I'm just going to step on the question of really a blessing. I think for developing countries, I think people are going to think about trauma, because the IMF is coming back big. And when the IMF comes back big, it's trauma. The IMF is being really bailed out in a big way. Lost respect and now is boosting its chest and is coming back on developing countries. Really, I mean, there is no sign of the IMF changing. And the G20 that gives the IMF all of this money didn't say a word about the IMF behavior. And even developed countries recognize that the IMF had failed big time. The IMF has impoverished and killed many people. And until now, the IMF is being asked to go save the countries, which means now go kill more people. So I think that for developing countries that do not have the capacity to have stimulus packages or to are going now to really go back to where we were even, you know, I mean, in the hard times of structure adjustment. So I am wondering in what way it can be now a good thing for us.
I really enjoyed your presentation. I just want to follow up the last slide that you have. I think that's very critical. If we can turn something that is a crisis into a blessing, it's the question of how do you make use of that opportunity? And so, in other words, it's very easy in a crisis to be sort of a knee-jerk reactive response, which looks for immediate positive outcome without thinking on the secondary longer-term outcome. I think that will make the difference between countries that are able to take advantage of that opportunity versus those countries that miss that opportunity and therefore stay in the same kind of growth strategy and pattern that they had before the crisis. So my question is, what can we learn from the experiences of countries who have experienced financial crisis, not of this magnitude, but you mentioned the East Asia, but I think you also have to add some of the Latin American countries, because I think, for example, I'm talking about the Philippines, how the Philippines responded to the East Asian crisis, even though it was mild at the beginning, is very different from how Latin American countries who have responded to some form of economic crisis of their own. So which were, you know, they changed drastically, they got away from the neoliberals. I'd like you to sort of elaborate on that, because I think that's interesting. And then one other thing, what I found was surprising, because I kept on assuming too, that remittances and migration are just sort of reversing and remittances are falling, and what you're just telling us is really surprising. And one of the things that came to my mind, and I may be wrong, because I don't have the data, is that the female migrant workers tend to be prevalent in the care service sectors, which are likely not to be affected. I mean, you don't get rid of nurses just because you have a decline. So if it was an opposite kind of, you have a more male-dominated migration based on construction, like in Spain, I think the construction industry collapsed, and therefore the migrant workers from Ecuador reversed, then you would have a different effect. So maybe the effect on remittances depend on the sectors in... Oh, okay, sorry. I may have missed that, sorry.
Be a little early to have that be the final word on remittances as well.
Three comments, questions. In the wonderful slides that you showed us for the Asian crisis period, we see that investment is collapsing. We also see that government expenditures are collapsing. Consumption definitely is collapsing. So if there is growth, which there was, it must be exports, which is not going to be here this time around. That's problem number one. So in this context, we know actually that employment never recovered in Asian countries to this day, those that collapsed. So growth patterns recovered because of exports, but nonetheless employment did not recover. In today's situation, how do you see the employment be? This is, you know, the area that I always worry about. And therefore, I want just to pick your brains on this. The second point is on the what you were saying on the IMF. Yassine said it better than I could have said it. I'm extremely pessimistic, and actually, Smriti has prepared a wonderful short presentation. I hope she has time to talk about it today or tomorrow. I hope today. It is getting very, very, very upsetting, because there is nothing stopping them. They have gained again center stage. So how do we enter that space, if you have any thoughts? And the last one on the opportunity, I think the part that I find encouraging is what the opportunity for wage-led growth, that it is a juncture where actually profitability itself in manufacturing and other sectors was declining, which led to massively moving to financialization, which led to opening up all kinds of borders across the world. And now that this is collapsing, maybe if investment cannot do it, it will have to be a wage-led growth. So your thoughts on all of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the very, very interesting presentation. And I was just reflecting on the source of all this collapse of the financial system. And I think one point you didn't make was this delinking between the financial sector and the real economy. I think that probably was the crux of the matter, I think, in the U.S. system. And it's not very clear to me including the investor, the potential consumers, would change the behavioral patterns, although I hear that their saving rates are going up. You know, because the fact was stock market inflation and all that, there was not necessarily the value of the stocks were not really anchored by the real value of the companies. And at times I think they were really delinked. And I think it just continued on that like that. And the same thing with the housing market. That was just one point. And I just wanted to share also one piece of information. I also recall when we did this study on the impact of crisis in Indonesia and about migration. And I remember the men who were employed in places like Malaysia, Singapore, in the factories and construction, they were sent back en masse, whereas women who are largely working in care, and especially domestic work, they were not sent back immediately. And that was really, in fact, I had a boss at the time who was a migration specialist, and he was kind of surprised. And he then realized that even the analysis of migration trends had to be also engendered. Yes, thank you.
Ma'am, East Asian crisis, those countries, there is fiscal surplus overall. Savings is much higher than investment on an average. So they are having huge export surplus. But in real terms, there has to be one identity, national income identity. And second thing is fall in agricultural growth rate in India has anything to do with crisis or just independently agricultural growth rate is falling in India? Yeah.
Some of you are falling asleep, so I will not do more than is it. Okay, thank you for these very, very essential and interesting and difficult questions. Okay, this thing about the IMF has come up over and over again. I don't want to go into what Smriti is going to talk about tomorrow, but yes, it's absolutely true that if you look at how this crisis became a huge opportunity and gave life support to the IMF, which was dying, okay? And suddenly now it's come back with a bang and it's out there and doing everything that it does best, which is, even somebody like Jeffrey Sachs called it the typhoid Mary of emerging markets, right? So, yes, that is definitely depressing. I'm not denying that, Yasin, you know, clearly. Why do I say it's an opportunity, however, is because you see that IMF model now, it never had, okay? At many levels, we all know that it never had the possibility of success in terms of generating inclusive growth and development. But it could give you the illusion of growth through exports, okay? What I'm saying is that's over. That's last year. That cannot happen anymore, okay? The U.S. cannot be the engine of global demand in the same way. It cannot and will not be. So any strategy that is expecting to go back to business as usual will fail. You're right that in the process of that failing, it's all, you know, all worse and everything's going to get really bad and so on. But it means that model will have to be rejected, if not this year, next year, 2 years down the line, because there's no scope anymore for that, okay? Now, you see, in other words, the elites themselves will reject it. The elites earlier were quite okay with the domestic inequality and all that kind of thing, so long as they could get the exports and the income and the growth and generate their domestic bubbles. that possibility exists, I would say, only for a very few small set of countries. Unfortunately, India among them. I foresee India doing that in the next 5 or 6 years. I don't think very few other countries will be able to do that. And China, it's already made clear, is not going to do that. It's actually moving towards shifting to domestic consumption at the margin and changing patterns of trade. Okay, so that's one reason, I would say, for how opportunity, which is that it's not just the analytical. I mean, put it this way. The neoliberal model was always analytically vacuous, okay? But it's now also empirically simply not possible, okay? So that there is no scope for even an elite-based development strategy relying on U.S. final demand as the main engine of growth. It has to change. So that means what? It means domestic growth, which means domestic market, which means ideally wage-led growth, as you said, Rania, and, you know, therefore shifting towards things that will increase the basic living conditions of the workers and peasants. It means changing patterns of trade. I would say that this is the perfect moment for a Chinese Marshall Plan. We have never in the last century, we have not had an opportunity like this, where actually, you know, what's always stopped South-South trade was resources. We couldn't actually finance the trade. We don't have that problem for once, okay? We actually have the capacity to finance trade. What it needs is a shift at the margin for Chinese to fund other developing countries to import from them, okay? Now, that isn't a solution to the ecological imbalance that I was talking about, because it's still based on fundamentally unsustainable patterns of production consumption, but it is definitely a solution in terms of the global inequalities. And there are some signs that some of this is happening, which is why, Yasin, it's true IMF is going to come in there and do all kinds of terrible things, but IMF is not the only option anymore for African countries. You know, last year, G8, IMF, World Bank together gave, I think, $7.5 billion of aid to sub-Saharan Africa. China gave $32 billion of aid. Okay, Indian investment in Africa was $17 billion. So we are talking about a slightly different world where, yeah? Sorry? Oh, boy.
I'll tell you why, in the middle of my tiredness, I'm asking you the question. Because today I read in the newspaper, online newspaper for one of our papers in Jamaica, that we are actually going back to the IMF. Yeah, you know? And there's an entire debate going on right now in the newspapers, on the radio and so on. Why are we going back to the IMF? And it doesn't look as if anybody has the answers as to what should we do if we do not go back to the IMF, especially since it looks as if the policy elites have already made up their minds to go back to the IMF.
Okay, you know, this I'm not disputing that at all. And I think, you know, Smriti is going to show tomorrow how what the IMF is doing is pretty much what it used to do squared, so that there is no way that we can hope for either a change of heart or any of that kind of nonsense in terms of the policy conditionalities. I think, though, that this, as I said, it's not something that can sustain beyond a few years. Okay? So, yes, Jamaica will go to the IMF, like 11 sub-Saharan countries have gone, like Pakistan has gone, and Latvia, and Ukraine, and etc., etc. It will come a cropper. It will collapse. Just like Thailand went through 5 IMF MOUs in 1998 and had to keep revising its targets because it did everything the IMF said and all the numbers came out wrong because GDP kept falling, okay? So this is not going to work. Yes, they will do it. It will make things worse, and there will be a reaction where they will have to, either the IMF will have to keep changing its targets or they will have to move on. Now, I'm not... No, you can't be so pessimistic. Then what are we all here for? You can't say everything is, you know, the world is over and we all have to go. I'm saying that, I know they're bad guys and they're powerful. But what I mean is that it's not, I think, unlike previous occasions, there is, not just Ecuador, I'm telling you, I mean, $32 billion into Africa, what are we talking about? It's a lot of money. Yeah.
But okay. I think you're being overly optimistic about China.
Yeah, because we
Can I finish? At least the trend with China and money flow is that the Chinese strategy for the since the latter part of last year. Remember that? There's a rapid turnaround out of Africa, huh? There's entire countries where they pulled out. Chinese entrepreneurs are pulling out. But not only that, the Chinese have now, and even India too, huh? Buying land in Africa and Latin America and exporting Chinese labor. They're not utilizing local labor to produce food and stuff. So I think we have to look at that a little bit more carefully than thinking that it's going to be.
I'm not saying everything China does is good.
Okay? I'm not saying even the bad. I don't care.
But what I am saying, and I think I do believe this. You see, it's not, I mean, for example, Indian businessmen are now investing heavily in Africa in various things, okay? And most of them are not good news as, you know, investors and so on. But as this friend of, as Tandika Kandabide from Malawi says, that look, it's always better to have competition among imperialists. You can definitely get a better deal.
I'm quite happy to have the Chinese do their investment. What I'm saying is that the way that you're thinking is going to happen, it's not. And it's not going to be a Marshall Plan. That what the Chinese are looking for are resources, are food security, land for food and water, just as the Indians also who are buying land. And that's not the same thing as a Marshall Plan that will stimulate domestic.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Why are the Chinese only looking for that? Because they're still hoping for the U.S. market. But it is a finite period of time before they realize it ain't going to happen that way anymore. So they will have to be looking for other markets. You're right. At the moment, they're looking for the resources. But at one point, they will be have to be looking for markets.
And I'll be happy when they are. I just wanted to flag one other point. On your health thing, just one more of the dismal point.
Somebody give her a feel happy pill.
I'm a happy person. I just wanted to flag, though, like, in addition to the fiscal squeeze that's impacting on sort of middle income and countries like the Caribbean in terms of their domestic capacity to fund health care.
Yeah.
The problem for low-income African countries, is that about 40% of their health care expenditure comes from ODA. So if ODA is dropping radically, then you have and there's no capacity in the state to match that, to offset that. It's a tremendous amount of problems disaster, literally.
I'm not disputing it, but I think.
No, it's just information.
But, I also recognize that, the immediate outcomes are bad, very bad, okay? However, it's also the case that 40% of anybody's health budget should not depend on ODA. So if it forces, even African governments to think, let us actually try and get a health system that does not require external financing, a good thing eventually. Okay, so what I'm saying is that it's not a sustainable situation to have 40% of a budget require ODA.
I think Iceland got a better deal in terms of conditionality from the IMF than a lot of the other countries that have gone to the IMF. Partly, I don't know that I can back this up, because I think they had also support from the Nordic countries who were willing to put in money and so on and so forth. And I think in terms of that sort of imperialist competition thing, where it might make a difference, given the tremendous anxiety that the U.S. has about China, is, if you're coming to bargain with Jamaica and we have the option of bargaining with China, which is also a deal with the devil, but I don't know if it can make a difference on the margin in terms of conditionality. You might still end up going to the IMF, but do you then get some space to negotiate a slightly better deal? I mean, again, this is not sort of panacea or anything, but it might make a difference at that point, at that margin.
If you look historically, periods of global depression have actually been periods of autonomous industrialization of at least some segments of the developing world. The 1890s, the 1930s, the 1970s, South Korea, etc., come up in the 70s. The 1930s is when there was, industrialization, Argentina, India, Egypt, etc., etc. So periods of global instability are not so bad for developing countries because they provide some spaces. Of course, there's all this other bad news. But, you know, the fact that we have to hitch our fortunes completely to the imperialist bandwagon is not a good thing. And breaking that, however painful and disgusting it is, does create opportunities that even our own policymakers might be forced to think of. I mean, that's really the point I'm making.
One thing...
Off!
One
boo! Wait!
One... You're being good. You're going to put it.
Wait, bad wait, wait. News, Susan.
No. I agree with you, right? I am one of those who are quite happy at one level to see the system breaking apart and see the things that we've been arguing about for the last 10 years occurring. But I'm also very realist. What I'm trying to say is let us be real about what the options are. Let us be real about what the alliances are, where the struggle is. It's going to take a lot of struggle from us to move our government.
Absolutely.
It's very clear from the G20. Mm. That move was not a solidarity move.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay?
Yeah.
Brazil, India, China, and those that led that move to revert to the IMF. Yeah. That was not a solidarity move.
Yeah.
That's a move of creditor nations who want to establish and maintain the status quo as creditor nation. So let's be very clear about that.
No, Mariam, I'm not disputing. I mean, but you know...
I'm saying let's be realistic about it so
but
we make
Mariam,
plans
that's
about where we're going to go.
Mariam, that's the bad news we know already. You know, I mean...
Why? Mike?
You too. X2, yes.
It's going to be positive. It's going to be positive.
Oh, okay.
No. What I want to say is, Mariam, you know, I'm aging and I'm going
to
forget what I want
to
say.
Into the live,
I wanted to say that I do not see us, first of all, this is the time, of course, for us to be telling to the IMF what we want.
Yeah.
Not the IMF tell us what they want. But I don't see the sign of this happening in Africa. Because even recently, when the IMF was not giving us money, the IMF was telling us what they want, number one. Mm. Number two, the IMF, you need to see also the political, the way the IMF is being used as a political tool of control by the G8 and the G20. The IMF is really used as a political tool in a sense that you keep these countries in check. I mean, it's like la raison de plus fort. Countries in Africa, you know, I mean, really, you have different categories of countries. But there are some countries where, number one, I don't see it internally happening. Number two, the political power of IMF has been strengthened. And these people inside the IMF, they are blind, my sister. They are not going to say, okay, let's change now because they are not doing that. I mean, you have heard their discourse. They didn't even come at the UN when they were discussing the financial crisis. They are so arrogant.
Yeah.
They just need to be closed down.
Yeah.
And I'm extremely angry when the G20 come and give the IMF and without saying a word about governance, it is just so unfair that I really want to be optimistic, but I don't see the signs.
Hey, you cheated. You said it was going to be possible.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Okay. No. You said that we. You said I must be optimistic, right? Not pessimistic. Okay. All right. there's since this whole neoliberalism thing that's been happening in Jamaica, there's been a upsurge of analyzing a lot of the Jamaican proverbs and analogies that have been used in Bob Marley's songs. And one of them it's I Shot the Sheriff. And there's been this kind of metaphorical look at the song where they say the sheriff is the IMF, but he has they didn't shoot the deputy, which is the World Bank. So we still have to deal with the World Bank. And one of the things I'm remembering, not just from that song, but from a proverb that comes from the song, is where he says, every day the bucket goes to the well. One day the bottom must drop out. Right? So, and I think, I don't know, if the young people are looking at it like this, no. Right? how I'm thinking is that, well, if they are seeing it as possible, then there must be something there, you know? I must admit, they tend to have a fear without, they have fire without much foundation. But the fact is that they do have fire. They will come with ideas like, you know, we need to do things like poison them, you know, cause which you don't quite agree with. But I think that we have to be hopeful because there is a generation of youth that are coming with different sets of ideas. So I don't think it, quite frankly, it may not happen in this lifetime. No. I mean, all right. Maybe that's what I mean. Our lifetime, you know. But I think that is quite possible that, you know, things will change for Na's lifetime then, you know, and Gisela's lifetime, you know, which is like, you know, and you and right, you know, so the no. So, you know.
Okay. Now, this might not be good for my sister, but I have to say it. I have to say it because let me start by example. In Senegal, for example, there was a very strong organization, NGO, called CNRC. And they were doing a very good job supporting farmers and so on. And I believe in 2008, they went to a meeting, and after that meeting, because they said something that the government didn't like, the president just wrote a letter to that NGO and say, you no longer exist, you cannot do your activities anymore in the country. And that's it. What I'm saying, when the government, no, hold on. I'm not done yet. What I'm saying, when the government does that, nobody is there to back up that that NGO. Nobody. We talk. I don't like what IMF is doing. I don't like what World Bank is doing. I myself am very critic with the model used by the World Bank, and I discuss directly with the World Bank. They give me money to send people to the World Bank to study their model and see if we can do it. I say, no, we did not replicate it, and we are not replicating the model. This is clear in my head. I mean, for me, it's very clear. And I'm kind of weird because you cannot impose anything on me. This is the way I work. But the problem is what? The problem is most African countries don't have the money. They have nothing. Right now, Senegal, Cote d'Ivoire, Mali, Ghana, what? They don't have it. They don't have it. She's talking about taxes, but they don't have the money. I don't know where the money is, but they don't have the money. So what happened is, what happened is, the real politics make that. They are kind of obliged to go through World Bank and IMF to get the money for the country. And this is kind of crazy. But what do you have in terms of alternative? What do you have? What can we propose to our government to do so actually they can pay the salaries, they can do, they can build school, they can provide health service, and so on. And that's it.
You know, if we get into, sorry? Which is? Yeah. Okay, I think Rania had a very good point that, you know, this kind of conversation we should really be drinking our heads off and having, you know. So let me just quickly, I think there was only one, quickly two questions I finish, because I think the agricultural crisis in India, the current particular harvest failure is obviously monsoon related and so on, okay, but the broader crisis is policy related. And that policy, that set of policies is much worsened by the financial crisis because of its impact on global food prices and global input prices, okay? Basically of food and oil, okay? Which brings me to the food question somebody asked. Why have food prices, when they went down globally, not gone down in the developing world? Fundamentally, because number one, devaluation meant that the domestic prices remain high. Number two, these governments have dismantled their domestic food distribution. Countries that have kept it, like China, did not see any increase in food price. Okay? So, but we'll come to more of that. But so, in a sense, it's the sort of neoliberal failure all over again. Final point I just say is that, listen, I mean, of course it's not going to be easy. I mean, imperialism doesn't go without a struggle, for heaven's sake. You know, of course it's, but all I'm saying is that this is that illusion of strength. It's the last jump before the thing dies, because that, not capitalism, obviously, because we forecast the death of capitalism many times, no. But that particular model of capitalism is over, okay? And that is going to maybe pretend to be very whatever and then collapse. I mean, remember how strong Bush looked a few years ago. So I don't think you can, yeah. I think the point is to see in the medium term that this has to be, in a sense. Okay, sorry and thanks.